Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. Today my guests are Matt and Ted Lee. I have Matt in the SCANA studio in Columbia and Ted from the studios of the Radio Foundation in New York City. And so Matt and Ted, welcome back to the Journal.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
In case you don't know who Matt and Ted Lee are, they are Charleston boys who have made it big in the world of cooking. And they are very interested in traditional Southern cooking with 21st century modifications. We kind of I don't want to say we discovered them because we didn't, but we first got in touch with them years ago when they were boiling peanuts in bathtubs in New York City. And the South Carolina expatriate community let me know that there were these pretty neat guys you might want to have on your show sometime. They're getting ready to publish a cookbook. So that goes back a few years.
Well, you can rewrite our biography anytime. I like that one.
Okay. Let's talk about, I guess, the real biggie on your horizon is a TV show.
Well, you know, this has been a long time coming. We've been writing about food and mostly Southern food for practically 20 years now. And it was always out there, but never really something that we craved or wanted. Although as we got into cookbook publishing, all the publishers made us very aware that if you want to sell books, you've got to be on TV. So Ted, maybe tell them how this opportunity came along.
Yeah, and I would say that although it was in the back of our minds, I don't think it was ever a goal. That was never the end goal for us. But an opportunity came along in that a producer out of Knoxville contacted us and said, I've been reading your travel stories in Travel and Leisure, you know, for the past decade, and I think that they would translate well on television. And we'd had a few experiences on television. We'd been on Anthony Bourdain's No Reservations and Andrew Zimmern's Bizarre Foods, and so we knew that we could have fun. I mean, we had a great time on, you know, showing those folks around, and we thought, well, why not? Let's take a meeting with these guys. And it was a producer out of Knoxville, but also a production company out of Raleigh. And that really seemed to be the game changer for us, because we'd been approached in the past by various producers saying, you know, because as soon as you start writing about food, people contact you and say, oh, you know, I'm a producer. Food television is big. I think, you know, let's make something of it. But they always wanted us to be sort of like caricatures, or, you know, they wanted it to be about the
they
drama
brought down
between
their preconceptions of what the Southern person was, and it was usually a swamp creature.
Oh, I was going to say that they want you boys in bib overalls.
Exactly, with a hayseed, yeah. So, we found our Southern producers who could embrace the nuance of the kind of guys who were raised in Charleston, and whose parents were not from the South. I mean, there is this fundamental complication about us, which is that we are would-be Southerners. In Charleston, it counts for a lot that, you know, we didn't have a Southern grandmother. And for us, that has been the key to us really appreciating Southern culture in a way that our classmates really didn't. They just presumed that Duke's mayonnaise was available everywhere in the world, and that when you went to away to London or Paris or New York, that you'd find boiled peanuts that, you know, is being sold by the side of the road. Well, we've always had built in that perspective and that real appreciation for how truly special and how exotic elements of our Southern food culture can be.
Okay, and so you've got this company out of Knoxville, a producer out of Knoxville, and a production company out of Raleigh. And so let's map out what you are going to do, because you've already recorded a whole series, a whole season, right?
Right.
How many episodes is that?
Six episodes in the first season. The show is called Southern Uncovered with the Lee Brothers. It's on the Ovation Channel, which is an arts channel in 54 million homes nationwide. And the concept is simply each episode, a different Southern city. So Charleston, Atlanta, Asheville, North Carolina, Louisville, Kentucky, Dallas, and New Orleans in season one, a mix of, huge cities and, you know, very modern, contemporary southern cities, and then places like Asheville that are southern treasures, you know, 100,000 people. But all of them, especially in this era, represent just such a wealth of great experiences, not just food. Food is the primary focus of our show, but it being an arts channel, we're allowed to stray and go extracurricular. So in the Charleston episode that began the season, we are dancing the Charleston. And growing up there, we went to dancing school. We went to sort of the cotillion thing, but it was really the foxtrot and the polka at its sexiest. And
you had to learn to waltz at the cotillion.
Waltz. Yes, the Lindy was very important. Yeah, at cotillion, they had that kind of record player with the lid was the speaker, and they were playing vinyl. This is back in the 1980s, and Proud Mary by Creedence was like the most rock and roll. That was their one concession to like you kids, let alone that it was our parents' generation. So for this first episode, the pilot episode, we thought, well, gosh, you know, we were never taught the Charleston. Let's investigate a little further. There's this bar on Upper King Street. It's actually a restaurant as well called Prohibition. And they have a regular Thursday night sort of flapper era dance party where they teach the Charleston and the swing, and they do some other things. Maybe the shag on occasion, although that's a modernist dance. And we combine sort of the cocktail culture that's really happening now on Upper King Street with this revivalist dance scene. And it was a whole lot of fun. Makes great television. We dressed like a bunch of weird thrift store hooligans from the 1920s. And, you know, you'll have to see it to believe it.
Well, because you mentioned the cocktail scene. So are you going to be discussing drink as well as food?
Absolutely.
We get to cover food and beverage in the show. So in Atlanta, we go to this amazing bar that serves craft cocktails. It's a bar and restaurant in the Atlanta airport. Unlikely place for an ambitious restaurant, but that's where it is. And we can also cover things that just sort of, as Matt was saying, sort of tangentially relate to food, like the dancing in the Charleston episode. In Asheville, we meet up with this really hot young potter who makes sort of one-of-a-kind vessels for serving food and sort of collaborates with a chef on, you know, what to serve their dishes on. And it's kind of like this intense sort of crossover of the art community and the food community. And we like it whenever that happens.
Okay. And you deliberately, if I remember rightly from the pilot that I saw, you choose different kinds of restaurants.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the restaurant culture in Charleston, certainly, and in other cities in the South is having its renaissance now. And it would be easy enough, you know, the expectation is, oh, it's a food show. You go to restaurants, right? But we're not restaurant chefs. You have to remember that. We are just, you know, the children of academics who embraced food as a way to tell stories and to dig into history and culture. And so for us, you know, the full spectrum of the food culture is really what we're after. We'll stop at a restaurant for sure. In Louisville, what we discovered was two different, wildly different takes on the Latin influence in Southern food. In one case, a restaurant that's conjuring up the food of the Yucatan Peninsula. For 19 years now in Louisville, Kentucky, the chef has been, you know, mining the territory of great moles in different styles. And then across town at Ceviche, Chef Anthony Lamas is taking his Puerto Rican heritage and his Mexican heritage and doing something totally different. You know, the South is becoming so much more diverse than anyone could ever imagine. And we're, you know, thrilled to be presenting that to an American public that, you know, in some cases might not be ready for that message.
Well, I almost laughed when you talked about the Charleston in which you grew up because there were only two restaurants to go to. There was Henry's in the Market.
Perdita's.
And
that
Perdita's was the upscale restaurant. The end.
Right.
There are a few others, but...
Well, you know, Roberts came in eventually.
Yes.
Which was really a hot item for a decade or more.
Yeah. But, you know, Walter, if you dug into the Charleston City Directory, the, you know, phone book essentially from the 1890s, you'd find a whole section of restaurants. And they functioned more like sort of like hotels would have a free table, a free meal. You know, they were the predecessors of the Meat and Three, essentially. But there were definitely places to dine out. But dining out was a different thing. You know, the culture was different then. And it was more about getting fed and less about this entertainment experience that it's become today.
And also, in the 1890s, Charleston, like a lot of other cities, businesses and homes, I mean, you had a restaurant around the corner or neighborhood tavern, and as cities have become gentrified, all of that's been pushed out.
Right. Well, there was that wave of suburbanization that decentralized the whole thing. What we're finding and what I think the show will portray is how the city centers now are actually in this third wave where they're reviving and being redeveloped in interesting ways as people are sort of valuing quality of life and walkability a little bit more, and as they're able to work from home thanks to the internet and digital communications, we're seeing this sort of second migration back from sort of the centers of the Northeast, families, especially young families, deciding to set up in, you know, Bennettsville, South Carolina, because that was their original home and they feel that they can pull it off there now, that there's enough there for them to create a life.
You mentioned the six cities you're starting off with. Are these going to be based upon your travel and leisure articles? Because you've already been to these places. Or are you starting afresh?
We're starting afresh, really. And, you know, we have that opportunity. Part of the fun and the way the research sort of happens when we chat with our producers about what we're going to cover is we give them our intelligence on the place. And then they take that and they sort of find their own things, because what we wanted to do was not just going back to places we've already covered for other media venues. We really wanted to be discovering things ourselves as we go along. And so it's really not just a rehash of, you know, for the most part, we've been to every place, but we're uncovering new material for us.
I'm just thinking, what would be new to you fellows in Charleston? What did you not already know about?
Well, a perfect example is there's this graffiti artist. He's now, I think, a muralist, Douglas Panzone, who the producers turned up and who's relevant to a food show because his murals often appear inside restaurants and on the outside of restaurants. And as you may know from visiting Charleston, Charleston has a great history of these sort of mostly seafood murals on the outside of seafood stores, mm-hmm. but downtown on the Market Street for most of the 20th century was this huge painting of a sheep's head on Carroll's Seafood. But anyhow, Douglas is tapping into that tradition, so we visited his sort of playground, which is the back of a practically abandoned shopping center on James Island, not far from downtown. And he has the whole cinder block back canvas to play with, and it's incredible to visit. It's become a destination in itself, and people on weekends will just drive by back where the dumpsters used to be behind this strip mall, and you'll have to see it to believe it. It's very realistic work. He uses entirely just freehand spray paint cans, but he achieves this kind of realism and uses this kind of distortion that accentuates eyeballs. He's got a self-portrait of himself staring at a tiger. It's like really sort of cool, crazy stuff. Ted, am I doing an okay job of describing it? I mean,
yeah, you're doing a great job. And it's something that we feel sort of has a connection to the sort of commercial art that you see around Charleston. That's, you know, usually it's just a mural, but he's sort of taken that mural into another plane, and every one of his works is more like a painting. At the same time, it has this sort of commercial value as a restaurant mural. And, you know, it's fun for us to discover. We sort of had the first episode, we start with one of our absolute favorite restaurants in Charleston, Martha Lou's Kitchen on Morrison Drive. And we end with an oyster roast. So we sort of bookend the episode with things we're very familiar with and that we feel really express the flavor of Charleston, but the episodes in between were really things that were entirely new to us. It was, you know, Douglas Panzone. We never knew that anyone was teaching the Charleston in Charleston, the dancing segment.
And then there's this one thing that we sort of knew about, but we probably wouldn't have selected if the producers hadn't suggested it and really pushed it, which was to go out on the water with Jim Dyke, who's a gentleman who lives in Charleston but owns a Napa Valley winery. He's aging bottles of his wine under the harbor, like in cages at the bottom. You've heard about that, probably.
Yeah, I've heard about it. But I must say, pulling a bottle of wine out of Charleston Harbor, or it could be Mobile Bay or Savannah Harbor, does not make me want to uncork it and imbibe.
Well, yeah, that was the great thing, is here we were allowed to bring a level of skepticism. I mean, the reason I say it's an unlikely thing for us to do is because to us that's marketing bunk, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, your gut level is like, well, who cares? But it actually makes terrific television, and it was fun to engage it on that level and to actually be out on the water pulling that crate up and tasting it side by side with its land age relative, and to find, well, there is a difference, you know, whether it's psychosomatic or what have you. I mean, there's definitely a difference. The main difference is the bottle has barnacles on it, okay? So from a marketing standpoint, that's gold. I mean, that's like buried treasure, a shipwreck. If you're at McCready's restaurant, the sommelier brings that bottle of wine to the table, of course you're going to pay an extra $100.
Okay. So it's all, but you're convinced it's taste.
There is a difference in taste, oh, yeah. And it seems to mature a little faster, but whether that's worth any difference in price, whether high or low, who's to say? It's all subjective.
Well,
but context is important.
Now, see, there's a historical precedent. Because Madeira shipped to Charleston, people thought, that's bad. And then it was stored in attics. It wasn't stored in basements. Was superior to just plain old Madeira.
Yeah, there was an improvement that the shaking at the front of the ship and the high temperatures. And so now they replicate that in hot attics in Funchal.
Yeah, I mean, that's after the Civil War. Wealthy Europeans came over to buy off wine addicts, the contents of wine addicts from Charlestonians who needed some extra cash.
Yeah, so
right.
Charleston's drinking tastes have evolved from Madeira now to, what are we drinking now? A Grand Marnier. Have you done a grandma shot, Walter?
I don't like the heavy liqueurs. I'm sorry.
All right.
When I was your age, once upon a time, the heaviest I will drink now is, in the winter, a good port with some cheese. That's about it in terms of heavy.
And what's your flavor of beer?
My favorite beer?
Well, what's your flavor? I mean, do you drink like commercial light beer in the summer, or do you favor a good microbrew?
At the beach,
yes.
I always drink a light beer.
Yeah.
But it's got to be in a bottle. I do not drink cans.
Oh, you won't drink out of a can?
I don't drink out of, I mean, I'm sorry.
You're a 19th century gentleman.
Well, I mean, if you grew up on the Gulf Coast and you had Falstaff and Pabst Blue Ribbon and Jack's, they all taste like tin cans.
But that's a good flavor. It's the flavor of memory.
Yeah. But in terms of my personal preference, there are a couple of imports.
That shall not be named.
Shall not be named. But the ones that come in the oversized bottles with the
sort of compression closure from France, I'm guessing.
Belgium.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. But when we just got back from Denver, and every restaurant there that we went to, they had different microbrews. So I would try. I would usually ask the bartender, the waiter, okay, I might want to try an ale tonight. Which one would you recommend? And hey, their stuff is incredible. You know, Mobile has got microbreweries.
I mean, this is another great story of our country, is that the current flourishing renaissance of breweries in the state of North Carolina, especially, but also in the state of South Carolina. We now have probably six different, you know, locally brewed beers to select from, beer makers to select from. In the Charleston area, where I remember there was just Palmetto was sort of the forerunner. So for our Asheville episode of the TV show, we had to tackle that beer scene, of course, and the way we did it was unconventional. I mean, Ted, how would you explain what we did there?
Our producers learned that there is a sort of trend in Asheville of doing yoga lessons in breweries. So you do your yoga, and then you have your beer tasting.
It's so Asheville, right?
It's so Asheville. It
captures that sort of new age quality.
Okay, now what can we expect since we're doing Southern Uncovered? Are you in your leggings and doing a lotus before you have your beer?
We brought the wardrobe.
Yeah. About the only thing we knew about yoga was the wardrobe, because Matt and I had actually never done it ourselves. So it was a great learning experience all the way around.
And at the essence of it, it's about how they're creatively adapting, getting men into yoga. Hold it in a brewery, have a beer tasting afterward, like guaranteed, like you can bring your husband.
Oh, okay.
And what was also ironic is so we thought this was just the most Asheville thing you could possibly think of doing, yoga in a brewery. And it turns out the idea was started by a woman who's a Charlestonian.
Oh, okay. Tell us more.
Well, let's just back up a bit just to say that, I mean, what's cool is that the South's food culture, and especially I feel the food culture of South Carolina, is built on shifting sands. I mean, whether you're talking about like drinking traditions through the centuries or restaurant traditions or the recipe for the perfect biscuit, I mean, the South is evolving, and that's what we're hoping to chronicle, is the ways in which it is. A lot of people, I think, react instinctively, especially sort of tried and true Southerners whose families have been here for generations and mourn a particular time in history, maybe the 1940s, when grandma was at her best and when Southern food was a certain way. And they see that changing and think, oh my gosh, we'll lose that. What's wonderful today is that so many people are engaged in the conversation about Southern culture and food culture and studying it like never before, that we have better information about what was going on in the 1940s food-wise than we did a decade ago.
Well, and I remember from an earlier show how you talked about the prepackaged items that began to come out after World War II. People thought of as traditional Southern, but it was...
Yeah, it didn't look familiar to their great-grandparents, that's for sure.
You know, canned mushroom soup.
Cream and mushroom
exactly.
soup. And, you know, I celebrate the foods of my youth in the same way, and even the packaged and prepared foods. I love them. And, I drank oceans of cheer wine in a year, which is a bottled soda from 1917. Mm-hmm. But to each, you know, food, its perfect mood and season and purpose, and we embrace it all. I mean, that is the point, is to study it all and love it all and to understand it and to place it in a context that's that makes sense for you. You know, it's a great wide world of food out there, and the more we know, the better we can deploy it.
Okay. How long did it take you to do each show? I mean, you're on location.
We spend about 3 days in each city. You know, it's low-budget cable television. We can't flood the zone and be there for a week. But it's amazing how much you really can do in that amount of time. Don't you think, Matt? It's just... we pretty much iron down on what we want each segment to be about, and then we, you know, allow sort of serendipity to happen.
It's not like Walter Edgar's journal, where you have an hour to work with. It's 22 minutes, and so we can do two or three great encounters in a single day and have to trim at least one of them from the show. And that process of condensing and really, you know, reducing down can be dismaying to those of us who love a great written work.
Do you fellows, are you involved with the editing, or is that the production company?
They do almost all the editing. Okay. And they run it all by us, and we see various drafts, and it's interesting to see how the show evolves through those different drafts. We're very much a part of the process, but we're not in the editing suite, like parsing each word.
What we can do is add our own voiceover lines, and that's been really great because it gives you sort of another layer of commentary on what has happened in the scene, and that's been really fun too. Just to see how the episode develops from the rough cut, which is the first draft, to the third or the fourth draft is really, that's been a real revelation to guys who are used to just, you know, scribbling it out and sending it to an editor and then maybe getting one revision, one chance to revise. It's been really great.
And yet it's all gone down in about a month, six episodes, six different cities. The pace here in television is so much different than what we're used to from cookbook publishing. I mean, it'll take us 2 years at a minimum to get through that whole process. And here, they're still editing the New Orleans episode as the Charleston one just aired.
Well, you know, it still amazes me, despite technology, whether you're dealing with a commercial press or an academic press, you turn in your manuscript and it's still going to take 9 to 12 months for a finished product.
Yeah.
I still can't.
It's amazing, right?
I want to ask you one thing about the Charleston episode and then move on to your other enterprises that you're going on. You mentioned you ended with an oyster roast. Mm-hmm. Do you two still hold to the old Southern tradition of only to eat oysters in our months?
Absolutely not, although it makes a whole lot of sense to do that, to sequester for our months, just because to have something year-round reduces some of its pleasure. But also, as you'll see from our debut episode, when you hold an oyster roast in August and you're doing it over a wood fire, which we insist on, I mean, we are traditionalists about the oyster roast, it makes for a pretty sweaty operation. I mean, it is not comfortable tending that fire. So, yeah, we prefer to do them then. Also, there's something to be said for the fact that the oysters are spawning in the summer and they're a little meager. They aren't as meaty. They don't have as much heft to them. And it's sort of nice to give them a break.
Too bad we can't get oysters that they got in the 17th century in South Carolina, where the meats were described as large as a man's hand.
Yeah, no, I know those ones that were probably 150 years old.
Well, let's move on to some other. I mean, you've got so many new avenues, and since the written word is important to me, let's talk about your historic cookbook series that you're reviving.
Yeah, well, this wonderful opportunity came up. We had a dialogue with an editor at Rizzoli, and he suggested, and we were sort of already thinking, that it would be wonderful to be able to tap certain classic cookbooks that we know about that are wonderful in their content, but were done some kind of injustice in terms of their format or the physicality of the book. And the primary one in our minds was a cookbook that has a South Carolina connection. It's called Princess Pamela's Soul Food Cookbook. It was published in 1969 in paperback, but in that kind of crumbly, like, disposable paperback format that is not easy to cook from. We knew it because we had a copy in our collection, but also it's just much talked about in Southern food circles over the last decade since it was published. Princess Pamela Strobel from Spartanburg, South Carolina, had a very popular restaurant in New York City on the Lower East Side. Very small, but very influential. And Andy Warhol wrote about it in his diaries.
Sort of on a lane, so that.
Yeah, I mean, it had qualities of a speakeasy. But so this editor said, you know, are there any books that you'd like to publish and reissue that we could improve upon in terms of the design and the layout? We could move it to hardcover. You guys could do an introduction, give it some context, do a little more research. And so we are going to launch an imprint with them, basically a reissue imprint, to tap different cookbooks like this one that deserve a better package and a new look. I think it's going to be called the Lee Brothers Library, something along those lines. But we're super excited about that. I mean, this plays straight to the heart of what we've been doing all these years and really digging in deeper and studying the heritage of Southern recipes.
Gentlemen, we need to pause for a moment and let you know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking to Matt and Ted Lee about their new television show, their new publishing enterprise, and we have a third one coming up, a live production in Kentucky. Ted, I was just thinking about putting this out there for our listeners. We've got good listeners upstate, and you and Matt have been trying to track down Pamela Strobel's family in Spartanburg, or somebody who knew them. And if there are if there are folks out there, we certainly would appreciate contact.
Right. What we know is that she came to New York at some time, probably in the 50s, and had this very influential restaurant called Princess Pamela's Southern Touch, Cuisine of South Carolina, was the subtitle. We also know from her cookbook that her mother worked a well-known
the elite restaurant
in Spartanburg.
And she was known as Beauty Strobel. And now we're very much, I know a lot of listeners from the area are going to say, oh, J.C. Strobel, the famous caller and employee at the Beacon Restaurant. Mm. And we're in touch with his family and Jacquethlyn Strobel, and they're convinced that she's not related. And in fact, the spelling is slightly different. We are commissioning some genealogists to look into this and try to figure out whether we can connect with a relative who understands or knows more about Pamela Strobel's path, you know, when she set out for New York, what happened to her after her restaurant sort of faded out in the 1990s. We'd love to know where she ended up. She was very tied into the jazz community in New York City, and so we're pretty confident we're going to turn up someone. You know, it's really a story about the Great Migration and, you know, South Carolinians moving up north. And so this story especially interests us. We actually met Princess Pamela back in the early days when we were starting the boiled peanut business on the Lower East Side. Her restaurant was right around the corner and appeared to be a beacon to us because it proclaimed the cuisine of South Carolina. And this was, you know, a miracle. It's right around the corner. But one of the things we learned was that she was very choosy about who she let in her restaurant. She only had a few tables. And so she would, you know, sort of pull back the curtain and size you up before she allowed you in the restaurant. There was this sort of hazing process.
Did she ever let you in?
She never let us in. Was, you know, fantastic.
I mean, you
were, I wouldn't let us in.
You weren't Andy Warhol, and you didn't have Jackie Kennedy on your...
Yeah, we clearly didn't have,
exactly,
you know, a dime to spare on the restaurant, so...
We didn't rate.
But the stories people tell from dining there are hilarious, and they begin with that kind of hazing process, and then it continues. There are all these rules, and you sort of had to ask for permission to go to the bathroom, and you were pretty much told what to order. You'll have the ribs, right? That kind of thing. And then, you know, it would become surreal. And then at this perfect moment, the whole evening would spin from sort of a hazing to a warm embrace. And you were a member of the family, and the music would start, and she would begin to sing. And I mean, people's remembrances of this restaurant are incredible.
All right. Now, is that going to be part of, I assume you're going to do an introduction to your...
Yes.
Yes, absolutely. And we've been collecting oral histories. In fact, if you have one, I remember Princess at thefoodlife.com. We'd be glad to receive your oral histories of, and they have a commonality to them. She was an incredible woman, and we'd love to sort of get to the heart of, you know, why and who and what that was. And again, she might remain a mystery, and that might be part of her essence.
And Ted, do you think she's going to remain a mystery?
Well, I do, but I think part of the thing that we found is so exciting is that if you talk about her food, and that's the reason why we want to reissue the cookbook, is that it has been influential. Her recipes have influenced chefs who we know who are practicing in the South today. For example, her buttermilk pie, which is in the Soul Food Cookbook, it ended up being on the menu at Crook's Corner when Bill Neal was cooking there, and it was printed as Princess Pamela's buttermilk pie. Now, if you go and have the buttermilk pie at the Hominy Grill in Charleston, Robert will tell you that his recipe is basically adapted from that Princess Pamela's buttermilk pie that he cooked, you know, a million times
when he was
at Crook's Corner. So you can see the lineage of you know, through the recipes, you can see this lineage back to Pamela Strobel. And, you know, in addition to the all this crazy culture that happened at her influential restaurant in New York, it really is the recipes that survive, you know, that we can see carried down today. So whatever mystery there is, you taste that buttermilk pie, and there is no mystery. It is an amazing, amazing thing.
Well, your TV show, Lee Brothers Library, and let's talk about this live venture that's going to happen.
We're experimenting in Louisville with a live show. We've always felt that, like, the kind of cooking demonstration we do at Charleston Cooks or Southern Season is one of our greatest ways of performing, where the audience can smell and taste and experience the food, ask questions, and really feel a part of the way we cook in the kitchen. It's a very intimate experience. But what if we could scale it up for 200, 300 people? That's what we're going to discover. Can it be done? You know, can you, you know, continue that magic of people being with you as you cook and tell stories?
I want you to describe, how is this going to be set up? It's going to be like theater in the round, so you've got people.
There's this beautiful theater in Louisville, Kentucky, Actors Theater, and our friend and colleague Ed Lee, no relation, but a top chef and a restaurateur there, has a restaurant in the basement of the theater. So the logistics are sort of worked out. There's a support structure for, you know, pushing the food up onto the stage that we don't really have to worry about. We're just going to keep it simple, like three different sort of cooking surfaces. He's going to do a couple dishes. Ted will do a couple. I will do a couple. We're going to have a big pot of peanuts boiling on the stage before the audience even comes in. We're calling it the Boiled Peanut Hour.
Oh, okay.
And if it works, we're going to take it on the road. And my dream is that we take it to the Dock Street Theater. That would be amazing in Charleston.
All right, you got the 50-gallon jug of boiled
yes.
peanut, whatever, the crab pot.
Right.
All right. And you mentioned three services. Are you actually going to cook in front of the audience, or are you going to cook downstairs and bring it up?
We're cooking in front of the audience, but the great thing is that since we have this resource of Ed's restaurant right there, we're also going to do a tasting afterwards of every dish that we've done during the performance. So there will be sort of this after party that happens right after the show. And we'll get to, you know, mix and mingle with the
250
per performance. We're doing it two nights.
Okay. Well, it sounds like vocalists today, the live concerts are the big thing, not the...
Yeah,
right.
I mean, that was a little bit of our thinking is, on the one hand, restaurants are moving toward a more theatrical experience and selling tickets. And then on the other hand, the saving grace of the music industry is live performance. Mm-hmm. For people who are chefs or people who are sort of like chefs or talk about food historians, like, we're hoping that this opens up a new arena, like a new avenue and platform for people to talk about food and to celebrate it.
And one of the things that's funny is, aside from all three of us having the last name Lee, is that Ed is also a would-be Southerner like us. He was born in Brooklyn. He's Korean-American. He moved to Louisville about 10 years ago. And that really is where, you know, he sort of became this amazing chef. And it was completely Southern ingredients that did it for him. Feeling a part of the South and feeling like a Southerner. And so that's the subtitle of the Boiled Peanut Hour, is a live cooking show about Southern identities. And we will tell stories and make light of the fact that here these three guys are who are known to be, you know, quote unquote, Southern food experts. And none of the three of us have a Southern grandmother.
Well, you don't have a Southern grandmother. But there are people who run around and say, Southern by the grace of God and this sort of thing. And I had a dear friend who, that was in his obituary not too long ago. But you have self-identified as South Carolinians, as people, by the way, have done for more than 300 years. South Carolina has been a big place where people have come to it from all corners of the globe.
Well, yeah, I mean, we're going to tell that story through the ingredients. We're, especially I am, going to dig down deep in cooking on stage, just really parsing the native origins of all the different ingredients. I recently discovered camellia oil as a cooking ingredient. It's very common in Asia to use camellia oil. And I think of there's nothing more southern than camellias. Mm-hmm. But it's an oil extracted from the nut, and it's a very high heat oil. And now I use it in place of canola, you know, just for any high heat thing, searing some steak.
I'm just trying to think back to the early 19th century Charleston cooks, even the 18th. Was camellia oil used in?
No, but, you know, sesame oil was. Yes. Sesame not being a native North American ingredient either was, we know from the work of Dr. David Shields, it was the sesame oil that was the common cooking oil in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, far more than olive. You know, there weren't really olive trees here. There were some experiments.
And they never worked out. I've got some detailed letters on that back to the Royal Society of Arts, and they just never tasted right. That was the comment is, yes, the trees mm-hmm. would grow here, but when they went through the brine, whatever the pickling process mm-hmm. was, they just never tasted right.
Right.
So.
Well, and what I love about the sesame oil story is, you know, it begins with the plant itself, native to northern Africa and Asia, and traveled here. It grows well here, and we've been to Sumter, South Carolina. There's a number of farms there. The Wanamakers are growing sesame seed mostly to ship to Japan, and you associate it with Asia, but it's a southern ingredient. It grows here. It's loved here for centuries. So it's really all about your perception and how deeply you dig into the origins and how much you embrace them.
Ted, you're in New York right now.
Yes, sir.
Are you based out of New York now instead of I know Matt's got family in Charleston, so he's kind of anchored there. Are you?
Matt is anchored in Charleston with the family. My wife and I we're mostly based in New York, in Brooklyn. My wife's a sculptor. And her studio's in Brooklyn. And so I spend virtually all my time here, except when I'm traveling for the show or, you know, I go to Charleston probably usually twice a month, just because, you know, that's the engine of our inspiration. And that really, you know, I truly feel that it's my home. You know, spiritually, that is where I'm from, and that's where our office is. So I'm there usually once or twice a month.
All right.
But I love having this perspective of, you know, like Matt was saying, we're always interested in cross-cultural connections between New York and Charleston. And I love having a home in both places, feeling at home in both places. Fortunately, now it's easy because there's this quick regional jet.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you about New York. There used to be a close-knit expat community. That's where you fellows started off. Does that still mm-hmm. exist in New York?
Oh, yeah. And I think, if anything, it's sort of been galvanized by the fact that, you know, New York in the past 5 years has come to appreciate Southern food in a way it just didn't before. Now there are real Southern restaurants doing really great work that are on par with, you know, restaurants that we find in Nashville and Charleston and Asheville. You know, these are chefs from the South who've opened restaurants here focusing on Southern ingredients and Southern preparations, and there are many that are doing it really well, which we really couldn't say 5 or 10 years ago.
Unless you're talking about Princess Pamela's restaurant.
Yeah. Right, unless you're talking about Princess Pamela's.
A couple generations before.
Cafe Bulow was a legendary, great restaurant in the Southern space, but, you know, until sort of 5, 10 years ago, most Southern restaurants in New York were sort of theme restaurants, and they didn't really take their Southernness seriously in a way. It was just sort of like slinging out ribs and fried chicken and calling it quits. That's changed. That whole thing has changed. And so many of the Southern traditions, like pickling and curing hams, they've become so much a part of, for lack of a better word, mainstream food culture that a lot of people here, like I live in Brooklyn, and Brooklyn is just alive with people obsessed with pickling, Southern cocktails, curing hams. And that's a really fun thing. It's fun to feel like our culture is appreciated as far north as Brooklyn, New York.
I mean, the reason for our TV show is that that people everywhere are better educated about the South. They may have never been, but they know just a little bit more why it's a rich trove of cool stuff and great food, and why it might be worth the journey. And we're just sort of driving that point home.
You know, when we started off, you were talking about the stereotypes that are out there about folks from the South, be they black or white, there's a definite stereotype still.
Yeah, swamp creatures. We're all swamp creatures.
Everybody comes out of Deliverance. But some things that are advertised as Southern, I think it's just mostly out of New Orleans. People will say Creole this and Creole that. I generally steer clear of that on the menu because what it means is they have overcooked the fish. They burned it when they blacken it. And then they have gotten a crate of McElhaney's or Texas Pete or something, and they consider that Creole cooking.
Right.
It's always important to parse the details and to dig in and find out, like, what's really ticking in the kitchen, because a lot of places are phoning it in and just, you know, opening freezer bags and don't really care about the food. And so how do you assess that? How do you, you know, walk by a restaurant or walk into it and appraise, like, do the owners care or not? You know, is this real food? But I think people in general are getting a little more hip to some of those clues. But, yeah, how do you avoid tourist restaurants? That's the question. Yeah. That's what people want to know when they travel.
And that's true in every city.
Yeah, people want to know the gold. Like, what is the inside intelligence? You know, when I go to a place, I want a trustworthy sage from that region to tell me what I wouldn't otherwise discover unless I had an inside connection.
But now, is this competing with your other business, writing up in Travel and Leisure, and you're telling people where to eat? So you're revealing the secrets, right?
We're happy to reveal the secrets. I mean, the thing is, people doing good stuff off the beaten path, they need the business to stay in business.
Right.
And so we're happy to send it to
them. We've always felt that people like to be appreciated in general. So, you know, we never keep secrets close to our chest. You know, a lot of our friends, especially in Charleston, are like, don't tell any more people about Dave's carryout, because that's like, that's our little secret. And it's kind of like, well, yes, but, you know, they need to keep their doors open and we want them to be in business 50 years from now. So, like, let's celebrate it. Let's get excited about it.
There is this rare pleasure in this day and age. It's becoming rare of being a regular at a place. You know, what does that feel like? It used to be more common, and I think now it's just we've gotten busier and bigger, and dining out has become more entertainment. Like, appreciating that quality of being a regular and being accepted as one is really special, and especially hard to find. But it was our work for Travel and Leisure, traveling around presenting cities and cool things to do and to eat in them, that led to this TV thing. It's actually the perfect expression of the way we travel, which is mostly about the food, but not exclusively.
We've got about 3 minutes, folks. So, Ted, why don't you talk about where y'all are headed next?
Well, we are headed next to Louisville to do this live show, and we love Louisville, and we're just super excited. We're a little bit nervous, to be honest, because we've never done a live show before. We're not sure this format works, but we're sold out, so that's good. That's a good sign. But the pressure's on. But at the very least, even if the show's a total failure, we know we'll get good food because we love Louisville and its restaurants.
Okay. Matt?
Well, I mean, I'll remind you, Ted, of that one time that we opened up for Paula Deen in Myrtle Beach in front of probably 20,000 people. Like, there was a level of terror there that I'll always keep with me. But these days, it's fun to feel a little bit of stage fright. There's something incomparable about being real with someone in a room sharing an experience. And in the modern era, that's more valuable than ever before.
Okay. Matt and Ted Lee, we have run out the clock. I want to thank you for being with us today on The Journal.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you, Walter. It's always a pleasure.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. It's always fun to have Matt and Ted Lee on the program, and We've been doing it, as they pointed out, goes back years ago when we discovered them through friends in New York, and they were boiling peanuts in their loft kitchen in New York City. They've come a long way since then, but now they really are branching out into other media and other forms of presentation that I think is exciting. But I'm especially excited about the Lee Brothers Library, which will bring back into print with proper context important cookbooks from the past. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.